And next up, we have the final speaker of the day, and that is Emma Burden, who is going to talk about the curious case of balanced levels. Welcome.
Hi, great. So I just want to thank all the organizers for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here. I've heard some great talks already, and I'm really also looking forward to sharing my research with all of you. I want to start by clarifying that I'm only going to be talking about supergenes that are not at all related to sex determination today. So a lot of these conclusions that I'm going to be drawing are not going to be related to sex chromosomes. So people like myself that don't actually work on sex chromosomes are often interested in supergenes because these can facilitate adaptation. And this is because recombination between different supergene haplotypes, alleles, versions, we had this discussion at lunch, is repressed, which allows complexes of alleles to remain together and underlie really complex traits, some of which we've already heard about, such as colony forms in the ants, wing patterns in the butterflies, which I know we will be hearing about, and different mating systems, for example, in the rough. And my research really focuses on the other implications of this reduced recombination and how that's going to affect the evolutionary trajectory of the supergene itself. So this is a recent review that I did with Tanya. And I just want to note here that we were looking at different known supergene examples and what the genomic architecture of that supergene is. So recombination is repressed between different supergene, I'm going to say haplotypes here. However, different kinds of mechanisms can suppress recombination. And just a quick plug, in the paper, there's a great table of a bunch of different recent supergenes and what the genomic architecture is. Here are four really famous examples: fire ant, papillo butterflies, please excuse my pronunciation, pneumata butterflies, and primula. And these X's here are inversions. So we can see that three out of four of these are inversions, where this is an indel, as we heard earlier. And I just want to note that the majority of supergenes do seem to be inversions, and I want to clarify that for the rest of this talk, I will only be talking about supergenes that are underlain by inversions. So what I find really fascinating about inversions, as opposed to other regions where recombination is repressed or suppressed, is that it's contextual in inversions. So here we have two homokaryotypes, that's individuals with this two copies of the same arrangement. And recombination is proceeding fully normally. Recombination is only repressed in the heterokaryotype, that is individuals with one copy of each arrangement. And what this does is generate a unique population substructure for this region of the genome alone. So here I'm showing a population of chromosomes. Black is a collinear region, and the gradient indicates the arrangement. When I add my alleles here that are dashes, I've colored them on purpose to be either belonging to the standard arrangement or the inverted arrangement, because many mutations are going to be private to one arrangement because of this reduction in recombination. When we think about evolution, we think about these five forces: mutation, recombination, drift, selection, and migration. However, this reduction in recombination and this population substructure are going to decrease recombination and increase drift for this region alone, which means that this region of the genome can be on a different evolutionary trajectory than the rest of the genome, even though it recurs within the same individual, same species. And this population substructure generates what I consider to be a really dynamic feedback loop. So large arrangements are not fixed in time. The allelic content of these arrangements can change over time. And this is evolving partially through this feedback loop between arrangement frequency and content. So here I'm showing two arrangements. The content is going to contribute to the fitness of the different karyotypes. And here I'm purposefully showing fitness as a distribution. And this is because most two copies of any one arrangement are not necessarily identical. There can be quite a lot of variation within arrangements. These distributions of fitness will then determine the effective population size and the recombination rate for each arrangement. Again, recombination is only suppressed in the heterozygote here, or heterokaryotype. It's proceeding normally here. This effective population size and recombination rate will then affect the fate of new mutations and standing variation, which then completes the loop. Now, some of you have already seen me present this slide before, but what I want to do today is actually note that when we are talking about deleterious mutations, in particular deleterious recessive mutations, this dynamic feedback loop turns into a positive feedback loop. So here, accumulation of deleterious mutations will lower the fitness of that karyotype in question, which will lower the frequency of the arrangement, indicating that it's more often to be heterozygous, which is something that Paul sort of touched on. And this is going to lower the recombination rate and the effective population size of this arrangement. In turn, this will lower the efficacy of purifying selection, allowing the fixation of deleterious mutations within the arrangement, again, not within the population, further lowering the fitness of the arrangement, and continuing like this until it is stopped. So turning back to the question of how supergenes evolve, generally when we think of evolution, we think of interplay between selective pressures, so natural and sexual selection, and the targets of selection, so coding variation, expression variation, breakpoints, in the case of structural variation, or linked variation. And I would argue that this interplay is affected then by the feedback loop between allelic content and arrangement frequency. And a major goal of my research is to understand how this interplay between the feedback loop affects evolution here. And I would also argue that this question is best answered by theory, namely simulations, because it's simply not possible to observe supergenes over such a long time period where mutation accumulation and other such processes are actually occurring. So I'm going to tell you about two studies today. The first study, I want to note on this study, and actually both studies were done in really close collaboration with Alex Blanquert, who unfortunately is not here, but I really could not have done this without him, so I wanted to mention him. So in the first study, we were really interested in whether or not mutation accumulation was actually happening in inversions or could happen, basically testing out if this feedback loop worked. We simulated a population of 2,500 individuals. We let it reach mutation selection balance, and I should note that we only had neutral and deleterious recessive mutations here. The inversion occurred in a single haplotype in a single individual, so this is a single population origin. And because we were interested in what happened when the inversion was heterozygous, we gave it a weak heterozygote advantage to help it invade. And this is going to be critical later. So the first result basically shows that this works. Recombination and mutation accumulation are opposed. This is not surprising. This has been shown in other cases. Here I'm showing the number of fixed deleterious mutations in the major arrangement. And recombination here, it's not really particularly important what these numbers are. And there is a basically negative relationship between these two. I don't want to go through everything that affected mutation accumulation, so I'm going to give you just some highlights here. None of these effects are particularly surprising, but I think it is helpful to summarize them. So things that increase mutation accumulation are going to be small population size, large numbers of heterokaryotypes, low rates of recombination. So here this is gene conversion and double crossovers. So single crossovers are repressed in inversions, and low dominance coefficients. And that should be pretty obvious from Paul's talk. The converse will decrease the rate of mutation accumulation. But I do want to note that these parameters are talking about mutation accumulation at the population or the species level. However, we can also have differences at the arrangement level, which I sort of alluded to already. So here I'm showing you the cumulative number of fixed mutations in an arrangement. So fixation here indicates that every arrangement in the population has this mutation. And a color indicates the region. So we have collinear in red, the major arrangement in green, and the minor arrangement in blue. And you can see here that although mutation accumulation starts out to be similar in the major and minor, it vastly increases, almost exponentially, in the minor arrangement, whereas it remains very similar to the collinear in the major arrangement. So we can see that inversions and supergenes can accumulate deleterious mutations, but we can also ask, how is this going to affect evolutionary outcomes? So I want to introduce the concept of associative overdominance. I know Paul didn't say this word unless I missed it, but this is basically what his study is about. So associative overdominance means a heterozygote advantage experienced by a neutral variant, in this case, a supergene, due to selection on linked sites. So this can be deleterious recessive effects or overdominant loci. And there's been a lot of interest in associative overdominance, or AOD. In the last few years, these papers are all from the last, I think, 3 or 4 years, and many are written by people in this very room. So people are really interested in the role of associative overdominance in supergenes and in their maintenance and evolution. Our first study showed that the level of associative overdominance could actually promote further mutation accumulation. So here I'm showing you the heterokaryotype advantage that we attached to our inversion in this single population model. And note that this is AOD done by an overdominant locus, basically. And this is the mutation load in the major arrangement. And as you see, as we increase the amount of heterozygote advantage, we allow for more mutations to accumulate and also more variation between runs. So here, every single dot is an individual simulation. But we really want to explore further how AOD was working and how it was evolving. So I've talked already about our single population model. Because we could only work with mutations that were already segregating from our burn-in, we generally started with a quite low AOD due to deleterious recessives. Obviously, we attached this extra and the added heterozygote advantage. So we decided to do a second model, sort of inspired by Paul and Mathieu's paper in Current Biology that showed that introgression had generated this supergene in Heliconius. Here, we would have high associative overdominance starting at the beginning from deleterious mutations. And this time, we tried not to add this heterozygote advantage to see how associative overdominance might actually evolve over time. These are the four parameters that we varied. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but I do want to note that the burn-in length here is a proxy for the initial mutation load. So we simulated two isolated populations, one fixed for the standard arrangement, one fixed from the inverted arrangement. And the longer we let those go, the higher the drift load in each of those populations were, then the higher the AOD, or initial mutation load, of the supergene was when we initiated the migration. We also looked at gene conversion, dominance, and population size, because we knew from our first study that these were important characteristics. And we asked just three really simple questions. We wanted to know what kind of factors determine the strength of associative overdominance. We wanted to know, could associative overdominance stabilize a supergene polymorphism? A lot of the papers that I showed earlier were all about AOD basically stabilizing polymorphisms and allowing supergenes to remain for millions of years. And we wanted to know that how associative overdominance changed over evolutionary time. So the first thing I can tell you is that AOD is dynamic. You don't need to worry too much about the colors here or the two facets with gene conversion or no gene conversion. But basically, on the y-axis, I'm showing you associative overdominance and time on the x-axis. And you can see the AOD, although it initially drops, and if anybody's curious about why, I will tell you later. Just come up to me, and then increases over time. So AOD is not a constant force. So in single allele models, AOD is generally a fixed effect of that SNP. But when we're talking about an inversion, this is something that can change over time as mutations are accumulated or lost. Before going further, I think it's really helpful to take a look at how we're actually measuring associative overdominance. So these are equations from OTA originally, but the same ones that we used in our paper. So we're defining associative overdominance as S prime, where S prime is the minimum of S prime 1 and S prime 2. And S prime 1 basically associates the fitness of the AA homozygote with the heterozygote, and S prime 2, the fitness of the other homozygote, or the BB homozygote, with the heterozygote. And what I really want to note is that this is often assumed to be symmetrical, and this is because this makes it more mathematically easy to do analytical approximations. However, mutation is random and can very, very, very easily generate asymmetry. So it's very unlikely in nature that S prime 1 is actually going to be equal to S prime 2. And as I talked about, that dynamic feedback loop can become a positive feedback loop. And this initial asymmetry, even when small, can trigger that feedback loop, further increasing that asymmetry. This is just a plot indicating this point, that both symmetry as well as the overall strength of associative overdominance are going to be key factors. This is invasion probability. So this is the probability that the haplotype the new supergene lasted for N generations, N being 2,500, at least for this figure. On the y-axis, these is just dot different parameter space. This is asymmetry. And then this is the overall strength of associative overdominance. And we can see that both the asymmetry as well as the overall strength of associative overdominance are critical for the maintenance of this polymorphism. So even if associative overdominance is really strong, if there's a really strong asymmetry, we can lose the polymorphism anyways. So just to sort of reiterate and drive the point home, this mutation can generate asymmetry, which can trigger this feedback loop, making positive and going around and around and around until the frequency of one of the arrangements is driven down low enough that it can be lost via drift. And so this indicates that AOD on its own, without anything else, is going to be quite unlikely to maintain the supergene over long timescales. However, it can be very instrumental in generating a supergene via introgression. So, okay, I've shown you that this feedback loop can be pretty bad for promoting polymorphism. How do we get out of it? Well, there are several different ways that we can do that. The first is we can have very large effective pop accumulation in the supergene, and if there's no mutation accumulation, there's no feedback loop. We can also have multiple forms of balancing selection. I showed this picture earlier, and while I agree that both of these are forms of associative overdominance, the added stability of this heterokaryotype advantage allowed mutation accumulation to sort of run wild here. And so other forms of balancing selection, disassortative mating, negative frequency-dependent selection, temporal or spatially variable selection should all help stabilize a supergene polymorphism and could potentially work together with AOD to maintain a polymorphism. And finally, we can actually stop that feedback loop in its tracks. So this feedback loop feeds off the differences in the efficacy of purifying selection between the major and the minor allele. If we reduce the population size to a certain extent, we actually reduce the efficacy of purifying selection and also directional selection overall. And this also reduces this differential. So it gives the feedback loop nothing to feed on. So here I'm showing you two sets of simulations with the same parameters, except for here population size is 2,500, and here it's 100. This one you saw earlier, and you can see that the mutations accumulate in the minor allele almost exponentially, but not in the major. But when we drop it to 100, they simultaneously degrade. If we look at that kind of data from a fitness sense, here I'm showing you fitness of the population as a whole, of the heterokaryotype, standard homokaryotype, and inversion homokaryotype, we can see that these degrade in about the same time frame, while the fitness of the heterokaryotype is maintained. And this actually scenario here leads to this really interesting evolutionary paradox called balanced lethals. So balanced lethals occur when every individual in the population is a heterokaryotype. And due to Mendelian segregation, 25% of the population will be AA homokaryotype, 25% will be BB homokaryotype, and then 50% will be heterokaryotype. Since both homozygotes are lethal, this means that 50% of the population will die every single generation forever. And it might seem like this is actually just a relic of the fact that I used a simulation and there is no hard selection, but this has evolved over and over in the tree of life with examples in plants and various animals, and most notably Triturus newts. And I also want to note that this is an evolutionarily stable scenario. There is no way out of balanced lethals except for extinction of the population. Whereas other forms that we'll talk about in the paper, and you shall have to read the paper for it, can actually degrade into different forms. So for instance, half-lethal systems were not evolutionarily stable, and maintenance of the polymorphism with both homokaryotypes as fit was also not particularly stable. I just want to take this opportunity to show you another picture of Triturus newts and to promote our special issue containing this second simulation paper, and this is coming out on Monday. So, and it has many, many papers from many people in this room and also collaborators of people in this room, so should be of interest to everyone. So to summarize, I've shown you that the allelic content of a supergene can evolve quite rapidly at times. And this deleterious mutations can accumulate and affect the fate of this supergene and the polymorphism. AOD is not always stabilizing. In fact, it can actually be pretty destabilizing if asymmetry is high enough. And mutation accumulation can lead to to new evolutionary outcomes, such as balanced lethals. And although I didn't really talk about it so much, all of these results point towards the fact that maintenance of polymorphism, especially over long timescales, millions of years, like we've heard about today, is going to be really complex, and it's likely going to require multiple forms of balancing selection. And I want to refer everyone to Michael's paper that's in this upcoming special issue of a model in which they looked at the maintenance of this fire ant supergene. No, Formica super. No, I get them confused. One of the two ant species, supergene, and found that there was a really limited parameter space in which polymorphism could be maintained. So I would like to thank all of my collaborators, funding sources. This is, second paper was funded through an ERC to Ben Wielstra, and everybody here for listening. And I'm happy to take questions.